Basically, the idea of this thing today was to float a possible project. So it's Easter Sunday. Not many people come, but that doesn't matter, because if even one or two people are interested in the project, then we could do much more with it. To explain the reason for doing this even, or why it's interesting, I kind of want to tell you a little anecdote. Basically, a little life story thing. I used to live in Paris. I lived in Paris for about 20 years. And there, in the last half of that, I got to be friends with the people from the tradition called Italian autonomous Marxism, l'autonomia italiana. So that's people like Tony Negri, and Maurizio Lazzarato, and Paolo Virno, and Bifo. The last two didn't live in Paris, but they were part of this journal that existed at the time and still does, called Multitudes. And so they're really very interesting people. And what they worked in the 60s. They did like labor organization in the big industrial areas of Italy, like the Veneto around Venice, or Torino, where the automobile industry was and still is. And they, in the 70s, they got much wilder. This is when the idea of autonomous Marxism came about, and they started to, you know, of course, there was a counterculture in Italy. There was a very strong political movement. This went on, the 68 went on in Italy all the way till basically 1979, at which point there was an abortive sort of insurrectional moment in the country, and many people thought it was going to be a revolution. And at the end of that, a lot of these guys ended up in jail. And so once I was in Barcelona hanging out with Virno at an event that we were doing for a week or two, and we were walking back one night from wherever we had been in the night, and he started talking about what it was like to be in jail with the comrades, you know, and to actually have seminars in jail. They would get together in jail and try and work on their position, their theory, and so on. And that was in the late, you know, 70s, early 80s. And when they got out of jail, only a few years later on, they got out and society had completely changed. It was the 80s. Society looked entirely different than it looked to them and than it was when they went into jails a few years before. And Virno said to me that we wanted to take revenge on the state for what they did to us and for what they did to our movement. But to do that, we had to completely change our theories. And so they set about trying to understand the new society that really was, they were faced with, that in which they initially felt like strangers. And they gradually began to theorize this society. And what they said about it mainly is they made certain kind of claims. You know, they focused on flexible or precarious labor, which they ended up calling immaterial labor. And they said that this arose from the refusal of work in the factory by the factory workers, which certainly has a grain of truth to it. People did not want to be disciplined in that way. They didn't want to be subjected to factory work anymore. And they pointed to a much greater autonomy of the workers. So this is kind of what they're talking about, people who no longer work in fixed places, in a single place under the direct eye of a foreman, and so on and so on and so on. And they also tried to explain how society changed and how there you could understand something like a control society, which was meant to control people in their autonomy, to set up, Foucault called this governmentality. There are different versions of this idea. Of course, the control society comes from Deleuze, but doesn't really matter. The point is that they told this story, which was a really powerful story, about the refusal of work, the exodus from the factory, the attempt to set up different ways of life, the partial success of this attempt, the continual transformations of that attempt through time, and also the way that society reacted. And the story was told very well, and it spread a lot. And a lot of people started to understand their situation in this way. I myself, hearing all the details of this, reading in a theoretical text with different aspects to it, recognized my own situation in this story, and I, in the end, started to tell it maybe for a more Anglo-Saxon audience. You know, I wrote something called The Flexible Personality in the early 2000s. And so by around 2005, we had all gotten really good at telling the story. And wherever you went, people were telling the story. And when you went to Spain or to Germany or to Holland, there would always be more people telling the story, the same story. And they would always tell about the exodus from the factory. And at a certain point, I started to think, this story is getting old. A lot of things that have happened in the past 30 years have basically changed the conditions under which any kind of story of what people's actual experiences and of what society actually consists in are now different. It's almost as though, you know, another cycle had been through. And I started to think that maybe I would actually live to a time when there would be such a great change during my own lifetime as there had been between the late 70s and the early 80s. That there would be a change that would be almost paradigmatic. That means that the basic coordinates of the way that society operates would change. And it seemed to me that it had taken the radical left, in the sort of broad sense, at least in Europe, but I think so here too, it had really taken decades to understand the change of the 70s, to understand what flexible labor really even is, to understand the new sort of composition of labor, to understand the way that a pattern of government gets into your head and the way that that connects to the forms of technology, crucially to the communication and organizational technologies that run through the internet and through computers. It had taken an awful long time to understand that. And it seemed to me that if such a change were to happen again in society, I would not want to wait for 30 years to understand that, because then I would be dead before I understood what was happening in the present. So I decided that I would more or less get ready so that when such a change would start to happen, I would actually try to understand it as it was happening to the extent that such a thing is possible. And those ideas became really much sharper around 2008. Actually, by 2007, it was already obvious that we were headed for a big economic crisis, big like the one in the 70s, big like the one in the 30s. And that such a big crisis would be a game-changing crisis, that it would change the paradigm. That means that it would change the technology, that it would change the organizational forms, that it would change the form of the wage itself, that the kind of commodities that we have would become different, that the modes of government would change, that the modes of punishment would change. All those things in societies which extend to the international regime itself, the ways that countries relate to each other, the ways that money, the form that money takes, and so on and so on and so on. So the thing is that this is, it seems to me, this is indeed happening. All those changes are actually taking place. And what I've tried to do over the past few years is organize different situations with groups of people who are interested in these kind of things to set up projects to try to see the change, to try to see what's happening. Now, I'm going to present here a lot of theory, of which a lot of it is contained in these pages that Wendy is handing out right now. And I want you to realize that the very word theory comes from a Greek word that just basically means to see. The point of theory is not theory for its own sake. The point of theory is to try to see, to perceive, to render perceptible these sort of changes that are happening in the environment. If you look more deeply into the etymology, apparently theorein, the Greek word, means to look at the exterior aspects of things. So the point would be to look at a lot of different exterior aspects of things to try to get at a dynamic which isn't yet really visible and can only become visible if you sort of go around the whole circle of society's different aspects. And that's why I put on this images here that I'm showing here, a sort of circular form which shows many different, or at least names many different aspects of society. So what I'm going to do is try and make a theory or at least tell you about the basic outlines of theories that can increase one's perception of what's happening in society. And so at that point, you know, we can dive right into it and the things that are on the pages. Now, that has come out of work with, it's great showing these slides because they're not visible, really, so that's great. I mean, it corresponds to the need for theory. It comes out of work with, that started with a friend of mine named Armin Medosh, who's a guy in Vienna, who has sort of similar interests. And we decided, he's very involved in free software and so on, and this is a open source learning sort of research website that he set up called The Next Layer. So in the context of the work with him, we decided to call this techno-political paradigms, because we wanted to look at the way that technology is also political. That is to say, we wanted to consider the changing form of technology to be something inherently and completely political. I thought it was kind of cool. If you could see this image, you would see that by Jeff Wall called Untangling. You'd see a guy who seems to be in a machine shop confronted with a huge pile of rope, very thick rope, that kind of rope that's so heavy that you can't really even pick it up. And the rope inexplicably is tangled into a tangle that is going to be laborious to untangle. And the guy's just sitting down there trying to untangle this rope. This is clearly an image of the labor of the dialectic. That's what he's trying to talk about. He's trying to talk about a situation where reality resists knowledge because it's knotted into a certain kind of pattern. So to try to untangle this reality, I'm going to use sort of four different fields of theory. First one is pretty quick to go through. It's about long cycles in economic history called Kondratiev cycles. Second one is already getting a little more interesting. It's called the Technological Innovation School, and it has to do with the way technologies change over the course of the long cycles of accumulation. The third one is a French theoretical school called regulation theory, or the regulation approach. This has to do with the way all the different branches of social reproduction and the governance of society change with the changing of the long cycles. And then finally, world systems theory, which is the thing that was invented chiefly by Emanuel Wallerstein, and looks at even longer cycles of change in the geopolitical order. Okay, so that sounds like a lot, and it is. But if you take it bit by bit, it can be interesting. You can interrupt me at any moment that you want, even to tell me this is just bullshit, what you're saying. Kondratiev was a guy, a Russian, who therefore became a Soviet in the 1910s, in the course of the 1910s, and he was an economist. And he looked at some data about prices, which economists tend to do. And he saw, in several different things, he saw patterns like this. These are wholesale prices for things like wheat. They're commodity prices, and they're actually taken from the United States, the history of the United States. So Kondratiev was writing in 1920s, and so he was able to see three different waves where there was a peak and then a kind of fall with some jaggedness and another peak and then a fall and then another peak. And when he published his theory was right after the Second World War in the 20s, and there was beginning a sort of sharp fall, which I think actually would be one of these spikes here, and then there was a big rise in throughout the course of the 20s, and then the huge fall of the Depression, and there was another one of these cyclical things that went on. And so this theory seemed to show something about reality. there are long waves of economic development that are not the traditional 10 or 11-year business cycle, but are somehow unfold over, Kondratiev thought, 45 to 60 years. And they're recognizable because every 45 or 60 years, there are these big economic slowdowns, as there was in the 1890s, as there was in the 1930s, as there was in the 1970s, and as there is now. And what is more, he believed, and people gradually came to believe, that those things are associated with different technologies. So you can see, like, the steam engine and cotton as at the very start of the Industrial Revolution, the railways and steel in a second big wave going up to the last quarter of the 19th century, the electrical engineering and chemical things, which were those big, you know, in Germany, for instance, was really famous for this, but think of Edison in the United States. Think also of Standard Oil, which is, you know, oil is all connected to chemical production, right? These are big monopolistic industries.
PCBs,
yeah, exactly. Comes a bit later, but petrochemicals and automobiles, that's where we really get into PCBs, which would be from the the 30s, you know, right wave rising in the 30s, reaching its height somewhere around 1950, 1955, beginning to decline and hitting, its bottom point in the 70s. And then a last wave that we've lived through of information technology, clearly reaching a height sometime around the turn of the millennium and clearly declining right now. Now, Kondratiev says, the text that I've written here says, using data on prices, interest rates, wages, and foreign trade in France, England, and the USA, and on total coal and pig iron production in the world, Kondratiev was able to identify three long waves, rising from 1789 to a peak in 1814, then declining all the way to 1848, rising to another peak in 1873, then declining till 1896, which was the end of that sort of long depression at that time, and then rising to a peak around 1920 when he wrote. So he used statistical things, which is really the weakness of this theory, to smooth out the curves. Problem is, you can use those statistical things to produce anything you want. So this is only an indication of something interesting. It does not prove anything. And I am not a believer in any kind of numerology, any sort of, I don't think a graph will tell you what the future will be or what the present is. But what Kondratiev said, which is really interesting, is this. He said, the long waves really belong, the long 45 to 60 year waves, really belong to the same complex dynamic process in which the intermediate cycles of the capitalistic economy, with their principal phases of upswing and depression, run their course. These intermediate cycles, however, secure a certain stamp from the very existence of the long waves. In other words, the general fluctuation of the economy is given a certain character by the existence of longer waves, which are not that sharp up and down general fluctuation. He says, our investigation demonstrates that during the rise of the long waves, years of prosperity are more numerous, whereas years of depression predominate during the downswing. And then even equally importantly, he observed that large numbers of technological inventions occurred during the depressions, but were only applied during the next expansion. Do you get that? There would be lots of inventions during the depressions, but why wouldn't they be applied until the next expansion?
Investments that they already made for growth were sort of determining the way in which they produced, and suddenly when a depression comes, you can no longer rely on those old methods of growth, so you invest your money elsewhere to produce something new.
Well, during the depression, you actually don't invest your money because you're afraid. So there's periods where investment is kept as liquid as possible. It's what Keynes talked about, the liquidity preference, you know. So that's it. I mean, what you're saying is exactly it. One sort of technology comes to predominate. It saturates the market, as it were. It saturates. All industries are working in that same way, in the way that all industries became Fordist, mass assembly line production industries during the 1950s. Everywhere in the world this happened, you know. And then when the 70s came, everybody stops investing. They're afraid to invest. Those industries are in a crisis. Ford, GM, and so on are in a crisis. And many inventions happen, but there's no money for those inventions because it's a depression. It's a strong recession in the 70s. And so inventions build up. And it's when the economy finds a new fit, between all the different factors of society, technology, labor, geopolitics, and so on, when the thing starts moving again and swinging, and those curves start to go up, suddenly there's money available for what are clearly important inventions, which are going to be turned into technology or turned into what Schumpeter calls innovations. That is, an invention that gets produced and changes the way people work, the way people live, the way people consume, and also the way states function. So on the upswing, there comes a certain part where the upswing really swings up because the new technologies start to kick in. Do you want to say something?
It's just a thought, and I may be jumping ahead, but what if when the sites of invention become already owned privately anyway? Because inventions are happening in some focused situation, be it in research laboratories, universities, or maybe in other sites I'm not thinking of. But now those sites are becoming owned already, so it's almost maybe we have to be nervous of the inventions themselves.
Of course.
Having, you know, like, there's no pure invention.
Not at all. I don't think so at all. I mean, one has to, yes, exactly. One has to be nervous about everything. I mean, the idea that the, you know, inventions are some of those terrible things possible, and the idea that they haven't been owned and controlled for a long time is just wrong. I mean, from the late 19th century onward, especially in Germany, and then the United States imitated Germany, corporations started to organize big research labs. So in the United States, that was Bell Labs was one of the really big ones. What were the other ones? There's a couple of other ones that lasted for a long time. Then during the Second World War, in both countries, and above all in the United States, the state stepped in and organized that research and gave tremendous amounts of money to it. And then after the 70s, when there was a certain backlash from people like us about that very thing, the state changed its stripes like a chameleon and changed the way it organized research. It still reorganizes research tremendously, but now it does it underhandedly with a much more canny way of stimulating and coordinating separated branches of research. So all that doesn't really, that's been going on for a long time, and the dynamic of sort of depression and contraction and expansion still has the same sort of effects. Basically, we all live through this, even depending on how old you are or whether you noticed or not, but in the 80s in the United States and then everywhere in the world in the 90s, there was a tremendous investment in the technologies of communication. And you know, the whole world was cabled with fiber optic cable. This represented a tremendous investment. The internet had been invented in 1968, thank God, because that meant that it was stamped with a radical character of the time. But it was not became the object of industrial investment until the mid-1990s. And when it did, what a change in the world, and what a wave of transformation that we lived through. It's really incredible. And in fact, in the United States, we had already been living through that kind of transformation throughout the 80s. But this was more confined to the United States. To a lesser degree, Western Europe and Japan, but it didn't have the transformatory power that it did after the end of the Soviet Union, when the capitalists really felt like, now we can invest. We can invest wherever we want. We can invest in Africa. We can invest all over the East. We can invest in China. And they did. And they took that toolkit that had been developed from the 70s on, because, you know, the microprocessor was invented in the 70s. As I said, the internet was actually perfected in the 70s and so on. And they invested in it with all that money that had been tied up in more stable things, that had been tied up in financial things, so was thrown into actual production. And the face of the earth has been changed by that. So this is another thing, reason why I'm passionately interested in this, because I've lived through this, and since I travel a lot, I've been to Asia, and I've seen what happened in Asia during this time, and it's really phenomenal. It's really amazing. So, listen, the world, is the world good or bad? I'm afraid of it, if you want to know the truth. But is it good or bad? A lot of it's bad. Clearly. Clearly. And when they start to invest in new technologies, it's dangerous. And if people can somehow say no to certain things, like we should say no to biometric technology and so on, you know, to the kind of surveillance technology that they're now going, I mean, they haven't even started to invest in that stuff, in my opinion. In my opinion, that will be with nanotechnologies and so on that will be part of what could be the new wave of investment. I want to know about this shit as it happens and not when it's happening to me. I want to know about it in advance, and I want to protest it and change it if possible. So so this was back in the 20s, Kondratiev. And you know, Trotsky may be a pain in the ass sometimes, but he was smart. Trotsky had the same idea at the same time, independently of Kondratiev. And so you can read his text, for instance, at the Congress of the Communist International in June 1920, where he said, the fact that a depression had just started, a sharp recession, the one that provoked Thorsten Veblen to write his great stuff in America and so on. Trotsky said, observing this sharp recession, he said, the fact that capitalism continues to oscillate cyclically after the war merely signifies that capitalism is not yet dead, that we are not dealing with a corpse. It is necessary to determine the general condition of the capitalist organism by the specific way in which it breathes and the rate at which its pulse beats. So he identified the same periods as Kondratiev, but he attributed the turning points to external rather than inherent factors. Where Kondratiev said that it's inherent to the nature of the capitalist economy for it to go through these waves, Trotsky said that it depended on political changes. The changes in the curve of capitalist development were essentially political. So he said the absorption by capitalism of new countries and continents, the discovery of new natural resources, and in addition, significant factors of a superstructural order, such as wars and revolutions, determine the character and alteration of expansive, stagnating, or declining epochs in capitalist development. It's quite well said. And on his chart, he's got these great stuff. You know, event A, emergence of a new political party. Event B, revolution. Event C, another event that happens. It might be an earthquake. Social reform, victory of literary school X, he puts in there as being part of the curve of capitalist development. And these are external things. War, another event. And then the spread of philosophical current Y could also be incredibly important. That is to say that all these different factors influence the way that what he calls the curve of capitalist development. And I agree with that entirely. I think that it can't be reduced to some automatically self-generating wave by any means at all. And indeed, the very idea of the waves has to be a little more complex. But if you take that along, then you get in our time, basically after the slowdown of the 70s, because anyone with eyes to see could see that the world had entered a recession in the 70s and that the mass production technologies were no longer producing as much profit as they used to. They didn't disappear, they've never disappeared, but they weren't producing that great amount of profit that they used to. So many people set about trying to understand what would be the next wave, simply. And these people are not necessarily our friends. These people also want to be the counselors of the prince. They want to tell the governments what to do. What should you invest in so that you too can be a leader of the capitalist economy? Come buy our network, and you will become a leader of the capitalist economy. A lot of stuff has been sold also by these sort of councils. But it's not, they're not, well, these people are leftist, the ones that I'm quoting, but still, I think they're in the business a little too. You have to work with different kinds of material. You can't just work with the ideological stuff that our friends put out. Otherwise, I think you become a little bit stupid. So this stuff is really interesting. So they say, these people whose names are Freeman and Sutta, who wrote this big book called The Economics of Industrial Innovation, they say, well, just think about it. If you think about it, everyone knows these waves. They know that there was an industrial revolution that was all about the spinning mill and textiles. They know that there was an age of steam power and railways. They know, we know, if we have any contact with history at all, that there was an age of electricity and steel, which was also the age of imperialism, you know? Steel boats really changed the game for imperialism. Huh? And they know that there was an age of mass production, and most people even call it Fordism. And most people now know that this is the age of microelectronics and computer networks. So you can look into it and you can see specific kinds of transportation and communication happening during those different waves. Canals and carriage roads in the early industrial revolution. Iron railways and the telegraph in the first, the second Kondratiev wave. Steel railways, which is different, you can go much faster, and the telephone as means of communication during the age of electricity and steel. Then during the Fordist time, of course, motor highways, radio and TV, airlines, completely new set of transportation things. Of course, radio existed in the before the Second World War, and so did motor highways, and so did airlines even. But they didn't become big. They didn't take over. They didn't become something that everybody does until after the Second World War. And then finally, in our time, information highways, digital networks. You could probably add a few more things there. Okay, and if you want to get into this question about where does the technology come from, you would look in this column where it says science, technology, education, and training. So they point to those old days of apprenticeship, learning by doing, dissenting scientific academies, scientific societies. That was the Industrial Revolution worked like that. You had the British scientific societies were really important. So were the French ones, as a matter of fact, and here in the States. During the second wave, you start to get professional mechanical and civil engineers to build those railways, institutes of technology, and the beginning of mass literacy, mass primary education. In the third wave, which would be more or less the 1890s to the 1940s, you get industrial R&D labs, the ones I was talking about in Germany that the big concerns put together, and in the US, like Bell Labs and so on, for chemical and electrical engineering. You start to get national laboratories, and there starts to be the production of standards so that people around the world use the same measurements and agree on a lot of things, which is a big deal now. I mean, this is the globalization is mainly an affair from the technical point of view of standards, like HTTP protocol or something like that. Then so we get to globalization and shit, it's all the knowledge economy, right? So obviously, by the time you get to now, the deal of training has become so great that the key to being part of the capitalist elite, or at least being one of its servants, is to be trained, and to be trained in cutting edge and to go through lifelong training. So they say a lot of stuff in the innovation school, and I find it really persuasive. I mean, I think it really is talking about reality. And they go further, and they start to say, well, wait a minute. Does it really look like this, where it always goes down and then goes up again? Or does it not look quite different? You know, do we have a simple wave pattern that goes up, goes down to a low level, goes up to the same high level, goes down again? No, not at all. We have these waves which rise and reach a plateau, maybe stagnate. And then a new wave which comes out from underneath and which is starting to rise while the other one is stagnating and then reaches another plateau. And even these plateaus should be higher and higher each time, I think, because if you look at the way capitalism has developed, it's gotten bigger and bigger and affected more and more people. And more people have become part of the capitalist labor force to the point where in the 1990s, the capitalist labor force doubled with the last big wave of development. Because all those people in the formerly communist countries, all those people, particularly in India, but also all over Latin America, Africa, who used to be peasants, became wage earners and became part of the capitalist system. So you can see that the wave which came, there was a big, big wave of Fordism, which was huge and developed much of the world. And then the globalization wave came, and it's bigger, much bigger. And it absorbed China, which is, a fifth of the world's population. So these waves clearly don't just go up and then down and then up and down like some kind of stable thing. They actually, you actually have new layers coming each time. So there's some more details in there about the details of the innovation school. I'm not going to get into it. It will be on the website somehow, the materials that I offer here that could be used with this recorded thing. Now the interesting thing is that in these next layers, you have to realize that during the present, like right now, there's always the seeds of the next layer. It's just there in the state of a seed. In the same way that after the Second World War, all the cybernetic technologies were developed. So computers, were sort of all over the place. Only all over the place was there was one in Stanford, and there was another one up somewhere at Berkeley, and there were like 10 different weapon labs in California that had one, and so on and so on. But they weren't in everybody's pocket like they are now. Now everybody's pocket has more computing power than those weapons lab had. back in the 1940s. So during each layer, there's sort of a latent or an emerging technology, which is the sort of underlying the seeds of the next layer, the kernels from which the next layer is going to spring. And this table here, which we're obviously not going to get into now, would show you in column 6 a lot about that. It would show you what was developing while, for instance, while the electricity and steel production were dominating the scene, and, the telegraph was going, around the globe, and phones were coming out and so on, that automobiles, aircraft, telecommunications, radio, aluminum, consumer durables and oil and plastics were all there and were all being developed, but they hadn't yet exploded into the everyday, the stuff of everyday life, as they would during the plastic people era of the 1950s, when all those things would be part of people's everyday life. So similarly, there's nanotechnology all over the place. There's gene technology, biotech all over the place right now. There's surely many buildings in Chicago where they're trying to produce this stuff. It hasn't yet taken over our bodies. Sorry, watch out. It's, the question whether this stuff is good or not. What do you think? I don't know. It's coming anyway. It's probably coming. Let's move on. I don't have that many of this stuff. I only have a couple more of these, but this one is longer. Anyway, in the 70s, this guy named Michel Alietta wrote a great, great book. The book which is called A Theory of Capitalist Regulation. The guy was an economist. At the time, he was a Marxist. It's not really true anymore. It's not true at all anymore. People change. So this guy who was a Marxist in the 70s, he's a French guy, smart, decided he would go to the United States and study what was happening there. Because clearly, the United States was in a recession. And it wasn't just a recession. There was going to be another recession, and then there would be more happiness. No, it was a recession where things were going to change, where things were going to change deeply and durably. So he went to go see what Fordism had been, how it actually worked, what was the relationship between the work that someone did in a factory at particular kinds of machines, mass production machines, the kind of wage that they got paid, the kind of workers' organization that they joined, the forms of struggle that they had, the kinds of bargaining that led to with the bosses, the ways that the government organized that bargaining and organized it so that actually the conflicts would make the whole thing more productive, the types of products that were produced, the kinds of consumption that went on, how people lived and reproduced themselves, how it was that children were taken care of and education was funded and all that. He wanted to see how all that stuff fit together and formed this thing called Fordism. And it was really Alietta and so on that gave the contemporary meaning to the term Fordism. They started a whole school called the Regulation School. So there's a whole bunch of them. Boyer and Lipietz are some of the most famous ones. There's a guy I really like who's actually an English guy named Bob Jessop. And now his wife, whose name is something or other, Sum, I forget, she's Asian. And she's really interesting too, by the way. And anyway, these people developed an idea that you could look at society from many different angles and not just from the angle of technology. And then you could see that there was a fit between the way that work is organized and the way that reproduction is organized, that those things fit together, and that fit in turn structures not only the state around it, but it even structures the international order around it. And so you would get an idea of a regulation. Regulation in this case doesn't mean a few regulations that the government department is going to come out. It means a kind of rhythmical interaction that produces a stable dynamic. That is to say, it's mobile, it changes, but it changes in ways which are predictable, which are normal in a way, which people get to understand intuitively as the way things work. And then you come to a break, like the 70s are like now, and it starts not to work anymore. So Alietta did his pioneering study at the moment when it was not working, and he did it at the place which was the heart of the whole thing, which was the United States, and of course he did it with a foreigner's eyes. Now, this produces a really good book. And so if you like terrible academic books that some people consider boring, this is a great one. It's boring as you can be, It's like it tells you everything about so many different things. And I don't find it boring at all, but, of course, many people would find that boring, but I find it fantastic, actually. So they use some key concepts. They use the concept of the industrial paradigm that I've been talking about a lot. They talk about an accumulation regime. That means, how does capital actually make money? How does it manage to make money and to make a little more money all the time? And how do the leading capitalists make more money than the trailing ones? There must be a regime for the accumulation of capital. And a regime is the way an engine works. It's in French, this notion of regime, it's not just a political control regime. It's the idea that the engine spins at a certain speed and it doesn't fly into pieces. It's governed properly. It's going at a good regime. So there's a regime of accumulation, which is the way all the parts of the machine fit together. And that refers directly to the way the man or the woman at the assembly line is putting that stuff together and hitting that button and moving those parts at the right time. But, of course, when they're doing that, there's also investment capital is coming in. Goods are being distributed and bought. A new plant is being invested in. So the machine, as Marx saw long ago, is far bigger than the machine that you work at, or even that bigger machine that's called the factory. The machine is really the entire production machine. And that machine has a regime, and it's a profitable regime for capital, and that's called an accumulation regime. Then there would be a second thing called a mode of regulation. This mode of regulation has a lot to do with us. How do we survive the regime? You all know that when Ford invented the assembly line, He asked people to work at it, and they came for one day, and they left. And they said, no, I don't have a job, I need a job, but not that job. I can't stand that. It would kill me. I would go mad. It's so loud in there. Everything is fast. You have to stay in the same place all the time. The foreman comes and yells at you. What do you do when you want to go to the toilet? I can't stand this. I'm leaving. Sorry, I'm out of here. I don't want any money. Leave me alone. Okay, so Ford then had to do things. He had to raise the wage to $5 a day, double the average wage. He had to start to organize the housing for the employees. He invented a sociology department in the plant to find out about the employees, not just to find out about them, of course, to know why they don't show up at work and so on, but also to tell in their home, to tell their wives that it's no good for their children if the employee drinks, or that they really should consider taking out this loan so that they could buy their house, which obviously means that the guy's going to have to stay at the job, and so on and so on and so on. And of course, there were also women working in the plant, so it wasn't just the guy and his wife. But a sociology department in the plant, and very few people know about this, but this obviously has never changed since then. So Ford had to do all kinds of things to set up a kind of social regulation. Now, Ford was thinking about that, but not many people were. This is America. They were just pushing on the accelerator. What happened? Eventually, a social crisis. What happened? Communism happened in the United States. You know, the highest point of communism in American history in the 30s. The government finally had to listen and say, oh my God, something about the way that Ford has been more or less spuriously brutally and so on, but nonetheless running his plants has to be systematized and made into a way of regulating the rhythm, the regime of accumulation in such a way that people can actually survive it. And even during the Second World War, you know, the British and the American government explicitly said to the people, we know we're sending you away to get killed, but when you come back, you'll be able to live. Because otherwise people wouldn't go to war. So this thing about the regulation, the mode of regulation, became much more important than it had ever been out of the Second World War. Did you want to have to say something? No, just try and cough that spirit out of your body, yeah, really. Okay, so these guys are pretty interesting, the regulation school, and they say that all you put all that together and you get a certain mode of development. And the mode of development maybe is those things that we call Fordism or neoliberalism, so on. In other words, that's the biggest concept, is the concept of the mode of development. Now let's focus in. We talk about the industrial paradigm, the accumulation regime. We focus in on the mode of regulation, which is really what they added, obviously. They say, or anyway, Jessup says, it's an emergent ensemble. In other words, it's always emerging. It's always sort of being perfected. of norms, institutions, organizational forms, social networks, and patterns of contact, conduct that can temporarily stabilize an accumulation regime despite the conflictual and antagonistic character of capitalist social relations. In other words, this regulation could maybe make this thing work for a short time, 20 or 30 years, before capitalism again follows its basic tendency, which is to violently pressure people to the point where the whole thing breaks down. Capitalism has a crisis tendency, and this regulation does not get rid of the crisis tendency. It tries to temper that tendency of capitalism to destroy itself. And this sort of has to be done, and you know, Marx recognized this long ago, that the capitalists need a collective capitalist called the state, because otherwise what the capitalists do is fight among each other to the death. So the mode of regulation comes out of what Marx's theory calls the Gesamtkapitalist, or the collective capitalist, which is the state. So Jessup says that the mode of regulation is generally analyzed in terms of five dimensions. The wage relation, how you get paid, for what, do you get paid by the day, do you get paid by the hour, and so on. The kind of bargaining that goes on, and the kind of rhythm that gives to your life. The form of the enterprise, its internal organization, the source of its profits, the forms of competition, the ties between enterprise capital and banking capital. Fifth, the form of money, because money is not always the same. You know, money changes, and you can, if you think back to what you know, maybe because your parents talked about it or whatever, after the Second World War, there was this thing called Bretton Woods. Well, probably everybody here knows about Bretton Woods. Bretton Woods was that treaty which now I'm just talking about how not only does everything change, but money itself changes. So Bretton Woods was that treaty that at the end of the Second World War was going to replace the gold standard. And it said that all the countries who participate, their value will be set at a determined rate, allowed to fluctuate within a determined band, and each of those monies will be connected to the U.S. dollar. And if anyone who has U.S. dollars can exchange them at any time for what backs U.S. dollars, which is gold. Because after the Second World War, the U.S. had accumulated 2/3 of the world's gold supply. This is why they could do it. This is why the U.S. set the terms of the Bretton Woods Agreement, even though Keynes was so much smarter. So, because Keynes from England had his own ideas and maybe better ones, but anyway, whatever. Who really knows? So there was a form of money after the Second World War, which was this money that was regulated by the mechanisms for participation in the Bretton Woods regime, and also regulated by the existence of the IMF and the World Bank, which were founded at that same time. So you had a certain kind of money. The thing about this money is that when you went to France, to England, but also to, I suppose, Zimbabwe, and certainly to every country in Latin America, the money that you were going to pay was pretty much the same money that you'd pay next year, and so on. You wouldn't have these huge fluctuations in value unless there was a real big problem. And if there was a real big problem, well, also the IMF was supposed to step in and lend certain kinds of money, and there was supposed to be a readjustment, and so on. And this sort of thing, in a way, did work for a while. It stabilized the currency regimes. And in that way, during that time, that kind of money allowed for a certain kind of, what people often call neo-imperialism, or a certain structure of international trade, which was based on having this stable money. Now, in 1971, the Bretton Woods regime began to break down. And by 1973, it was officially broken and over. They struggled for a couple of years. And where currencies had fluctuated a little bit against each other, year by year and month by month, they, from 1971 onward, and then radically from 1973 onward, began to fluctuate wildly. So that the difference between the value of the three main currencies in the world system, the US dollar, the German Deutschmark, and the Japanese yen, went through incredible fluctuations, and of course they still do. Only now it's the euro, and now we have other currencies like the renminbi that also fluctuate. And so we live in a world, the money is not the same. The Ben Franklin looks the same, but Ben Franklin is now basically run through a computer all the time. And there are so many more virtual Ben Franklins than there are actual ones. We get back to the, is it real or not? Well, I'm not so sure that all that money is real, but it did cause the last financial crisis, that's for sure, and it threw millions of people out of work and so on. But it's a computer algorithm. There are a mass of conflicting and combating computer algorithms, and at the root of that is the need for the capitalist to hedge against the fluctuation of the value of the money that they're going to be buying and selling goods in. Because they want to set up a plant in Brazil, they also want to do one in Mexico, and they want to do one in China. And they want to sell that stuff to Europe, but they also want to sell parts of it to Latin America and so on. How do they know, from 1971 onward, how do they know that they're going to be able to get the value out of that plant they installed in Mexico? Because maybe suddenly the prices of things there are going to be 10 times what they were the day before. And how are they even going to be able to operate the plant? Well, what happened is at that very time, and I think the year is 1972, Mr. Milton Friedman went down to the Mercantile Exchange and rang the bell at the first currency futures market that Mr. Leon Melamed, who used to run that thing, had put him up to and paid him, I think, $5,000 to write the paper, saying that currency future markets will be a great thing and we really need them. Every capitalist thought currency futures would be a great thing and we really need them. They were not just kidding when they did this. And they needed it because they need to manage the fluctuation of money, because we have different money than we did during the post-war boom. Entirely different money. Money which fluctuates all the time. So we have a different monetary regime, and that's part of the mode of regulation, as a matter of fact, that I'm trying to talk about. I give that example because it's so concrete, and also it's so sort of weird and amazing. You can see that something so abstract like that actually affects you every day. And recently, it practically, you know, threw the whole world economy into a, you know, a kind of tailspin, right? So that's really part of the way that we live and the way that we reproduce ourselves and the way that we relax and so on is really connected to this form of money. Finally, of course, the state itself, the institution, that is the institutionalized compromise between capital and labor, and the forms of state intervention change. And finally, international regimes of trade, investment, monetary settlements, and political arrangements that link national economies, nation states, and the world system change. And that's the changes in what they call the mode of regulation. So it's got those five things, the wage relation, the enterprise form, the form of money, the form of the state, and the forms taken by international regimes. We've all seen in recent times the rise of the World Trade Organization, clearly a very different international regime. And so there you have it. I think that's enough said about that. And probably I'm not going to go into... Now, this is the sort of story that I was telling at first, you know, how Fordism moved from, you know, what you could call Keynesian Fordism, because the Keynesian idea, the welfare state, the idea that people should receive unemployment benefits, that the state should invest when there's a downturn in the cycle to try and prime the pump, as they say, that's inseparable from the post-war version of Fordism. It's not the same as in the 1930s, even though there were lots of cars being made. So we could call it Keynesian Fordism, and then how did that change to what we could call neoliberal informationalism? Well, if we were to get into this deeper, and maybe we will someday, we would start looking at books like Manuel Castells on the informational city, or David Harvey on the condition of postmodernity. And we would see things, and I'll even read a little bit from Castells, where he says, modes of development emerge from the interaction between scientific and technological discovery and the organizational integration of such discoveries in the processes of production and management. The transition between modes of development is not independent of the historical context. It relies heavily on the social matrix initially framing the transition, as well as on the social conflicts and interests that shape the transformation of that matrix. Therefore, the informational mode of development will emerge from the interaction between its technological and organizational components and the historically determined process of the restructuring of capitalism. Which means that the kind of informational regime that we live in, which is full of computers and information and fiber optic cables and all that, emerged out of the social struggles of the late 60s and 70s and was given a shape, that very shape that Kondratyev, the long cycles imprint to the smaller cycles. The particular moment when the most shape is given from below to the processes of change in capitalism is the moment of the big crisis when social struggles, like the Occupy movement, erupt. And people start to be conscious of not only of what they're living in, but what they're becoming, what we are becoming. And so, in our lifetimes now, we will have the most chance, all of us, to influence on the form of society than any other moment probably in our lifetimes, although, I don't know, some of you are young. Certainly it's going to be the last big moment for me, I think, because those cycles are long. It seems that the way the social struggles unfold now will be crucially influential on whatever comes down the pipe next. And many different things can come down that pipe, you know. And we will never be able to control all of those things, of course. We won't really be able to control any of them, but we can give shape to it. And if you want an example, look at the development of the internet, one of the crucial institutions of the neoliberal informationalism of this period of economic development. Well, it was invented in, the first internet connection was made in 1968. One of the nodes, you know, was Stanford, California, right there next to Palo Alto, right there in the Bay Area. You know, the human beings were happening right up the street in Haight-Ashbury. A lot of things were going on. You know, Bateson was wandering around saying very interesting things. Big struggles were happening. One of the places where the internet developed and where the culture of the internet developed was at Berkeley. UC Berkeley, which was obviously one of the most radicalized universities in the United States during the 70s. And people wanted specific kinds of rights. They also wanted specific kinds of use values. And they didn't want other people to tell them what those rights were and what those use values were. They wanted to set those for an egalitarian use of this technological machine. The people who were doing that are engineers. They weren't hippies. They may have been hippies. They may have been smoking dope in the evening. But when they showed up at school, they were learning how to be engineers. I think you're very well aware of this sort of thing. And so the engineer is saying, well, no, we want this thing to function this way so that other people can use it potentially and change it. And so the social matrix out of which that big and also dangerous, terrifying, and very repressive machine came out of was a social matrix at least partially radicalized. I mean, it could have been just come out of the military, right? But the military soon decided they didn't want anything to do with that. They started to build their own networks. They said, no, this thing is not for us. We already learned enough from it. Forget it. Go ahead. Do what you want with it. And people did. And eventually they did, you know, many things. Okay, then you can do the social history of the internet. And it's a fascinating thing to do because you see that the social matrix out of which it emerged decisively shaped the form that it got and gave it those aspects of use value that it still has and will have until the new international order gains control of it and imposes a real straitjacket on it and all of us, if they're able to do that, which they're trying to do now. But for all that time, and crucially throughout all the time of globalization, you know, you can see that, okay, in China they built a thing called the Great Firewall of China. They really tried hard to stop the to close those potentials that had been built into the internet by the British, American, and French engineers, and then people from all around the world who lived in those countries who had built that thing. And they were not entirely able to succeed, and they're still not entirely able to succeed, which is a testimony to what that social matrix did. And the social matrix would not have existed if there weren't the hippies smoking pot and putting the flowers and the guns of the soldiers at People's Park at the same time. It's not like it's only the engineers that count. Why would the engineers have thought of anything but engineering and done anything that would go to war if there hadn't been people willing to go out and stick themselves in front of the bayonet of the soldier in People's Park and say no? Well, there's no reason the engineers would have thought anything except what they thought before, because society makes people think things in very predictable ways until people stand up and say, no, I refuse. And so, as we stand up, I think, today and refuse what's happening today, we're setting up the possibility to influence the next wave of development that, whether we like it or not, and I think we probably won't, will come out of whatever happens at the end of this big, big economic crisis that we're still in. You know, you can go on with this stuff forever, and I do. I happen to love it. So I'm not going to get into these slides that I'm showing now, but you can read them, and they're kind of hard to read, but they're actually not that hard to read. Just to end, there's one more way of seeing that I think can be added to this project, which is the way of seeing the theory that was introduced particularly by not just Wallerstein, because there's also Samir Amin, and there's also a guy named André Gunder Frank, and this goes back into developmentalist traditions in Latin America, and at the root of that, there's an Argentinian economist whose name I'm spacing on right now, but anyway, at the root of a development which ultimately led particularly Amin and Wallerstein and Gunder Frank to create this notion of world systems theory. And then people like Giovanni Arrighi got into that also. What do they mean? Well, they mean that there are sort of long cycles of civilizational development in which a power center, which they call a hegemon, emerges. And this hegemon takes and becomes hegemonic, starts to control the space of capitalist development, or of what they call a capitalist world economy. And they say that there have been only a limited number of these. The first one would have been done by the Venetians, who were big traders and big bankers. And you know, modern banking was more or less invented in Genoa and I think in Florence also. But anyway, at the period of in Venice, in that period of those city-states. So the heart of it was the Venetians, really. And so that would have been the first sort of capitalist world economy, which wasn't very big yet. You know, it reached trading arms out to Asia, and even Christopher Columbus made it to the New World, you know. Then you have a shift to the Spanish, the Habsburgs. And, of course, this is full-on colonialism, and it starts to be quite big, you know. And then you have a shift, and there's, according to Wallerstein, each time there's a big war. So, you know, you had the 30 Years' War in Europe, which ended with the Peace of Westphalia. And after that, who was the king of the seas for a while was the Dutch, actually. This was actually the Dutch Golden Era. We forget about this. But the sort of classical era of the 16th, 17th century was actually the Dutch hegemony. And then the English took over, and the English really extended the world empire and ruled over their famous empire in which the sun never set for a long time. And by 1900, the British crown could contact any of the viceroys all over the world instantaneously by undersea cables with telegraph connections. That's what the British Empire was like at its biggest extent. The British Empire obviously went into decline after the First World War and then was smashed by their best friends, the Americans. During the course of the war, what did the Americans do? There's a thing called the Lend-Lease Act. We'll lend you this stuff, but really we're leasing it to you just to fight the war against our common enemy. And of course, you know, it's just an arrangement. And then in 1944, the Americans said, you've got to pay. You must pay now. There's no waiting. England is in ruins. This is what friends, when they're capitalist nations, do to each other. England lies in ruins. People are starving. What do they do with all the colonies? And the Americans want to pay for all the stuff that they used to save also, you know, the whole side. So the British sun did set, finally. And there was hard times in Britain after that for a long time. And that's directly attributable to the U.S. going and demanding to be paid. The U.S. did the same thing at the Peace of Versailles, you know. They signed a separate peace with Germany, and then they told France and England, we want to be paid. It's amazing. You have to know this stuff about American history. But anyway, this leads you into something. You can read these things on the sort of handouts. Wallerstein and Arrighi have different ideas. Wallerstein thinks that a hegemon emerges, that there's a big war, which usually lasts around 30 years. Could be the 30 Years' War, could be the First World War and the Second World War. And out of that big war emerges the hegemon, which then structures the entire world economy. The world economy is as big as it is. It might stop at China. It did for a long time stop at China. It might stop only in Europe, or it might only extend to the New World. So it gets bigger each time, as a matter of fact. And then that the hegemon structures the world space, and it's hegemonic in the sense of Antonio Gramsci, that is to say, it's not just about power and control, it's not just boots on the ground and the barrel of a gun. It's people telling you, our way is better, and we're not just into it for ourselves, it's better for you. We're doing this to help you. You know, this is what America's been doing all of this whole time, right? You know, we came here with our gunboats and soldiers, but in fact, it's to get rid of your dictator and to help you, you know? We came here and we set up your dictator, but it's actually to help you because your leftist regime was killing you. We're trying to help you. And people believe it. They believe it until the thing starts to fall apart. Arrighi has just the same idea, but it's just more subtle. And it's interesting what he says. They say in our model, Arrighi and Beverly Silver, systemic expansions are embedded, so this way that the world system expands, are embedded in a particular hegemonic structure that they tend to undermine. So the worm is in the fruit from the start. They are the outcome of the interplay of two different kinds of leadership. So what, for instance, the Brits do or the United States do? Systemic reorganization, the way that everything starts to work on the same British model, the way that everything starts to work on the same Dutch model, or everything starts to work on the same American model. Systemic reorganization promotes expansion by endowing the system with a wider or deeper division of labor. When everybody is working in different factories all over the world, when everybody's trading as they were, you know, after the Second World War and as they still do, it's a wider and deeper division of labor. It's a division of labor that now integrates everyone in the world so that what I'm even saying here is the result of a global division of labor. The computer is made in Asia. The software is made, you know, all over Western Europe by people doing it free. You know, it's free software. Well, there's also corporations that help develop that. The projector, I believe, was made in Korea. Fiber optic cables were made by people who got a temporary job here in Chicago, and so on and so on. The whole world is involved in what we're doing right now. There's a very wide and deep division of labor that developed under the systemic reorganization brought about by the American hegemony. But at the same time, there's competition, and their word for that is emulation. That means the Japanese tried to be not only like the Americans, but better. After the Second World War, the Germans said, "We will never fight a war again. However, we're going to compete you into the ground and produce stuff until you are nothing." And this was called the Wirtschaftswunder, the economic miracle. So emulation, forms of competition, which can be military but are not always military, provides the separate states with the motivational drive needed to mobilize energies and resources in the expansion. There is always a tension between these two tendencies, because a wider and deeper division of labor involves cooperation among the system's units, while emulation fosters their mutual competition. Hegemonic crises are characterized by three distinct but closely related processes: the intensification of interstate and inter-enterprise competition, the escalation of social conflicts, the interstitial emergence of new configurations of power. That all sounds like theory for the historians who have PhDs and paid vacations in the summertime to read long books.
Except
it's happening now. Except that the BRICS, Russia, India, and China are involving in, that's the interstitial emergence of new configurations of power. We clearly have the escalation of social conflicts going on all over the world. Arab Spring, anybody? What's happening right now in Syria and so on and so on. We have real escalations of conflict. And finally, there is an intensification of interstate and enterprise competition. There has been for a long time, especially with the rise of Asia. The rise of Asia has been a tremendous driver of both interstate and inter-enterprise competition. Who's going to get, is it Germany that's going to grab the prize of partnership with China and the closest partner of China, or will the U.S. retain that? This is one of the big questions that's unfolding now, because Germans really want to be the best friends of China. They want to be the engineers of China, as they are to a certain degree, and so on and so on. So all those things are going on, and it's likely that in this phase of crisis that the hegemonic order is going to shift, that we will not live in the future, we will not wake up in a world in which Hollywood and Madonna or whatever are the universal song that's on everyone's lips. And, you know, people love Hollywood and Madonna. That's the whole thing of being a hegemon. You know, it's like, this is the best of the best. But the best of the best eventually becomes the worst of the forgotten. And this could happen on all levels. And it's bound to happen to some degree. The idea that there would be a one-world globalization and that that would be run out of New York does not seem to be the reality that's shaping up. So I think that in the whole thing of looking at systemic crisis, you have to throw in the kicker, the absolute, the big one of them all, which is the world systems theory.